You are listening to Radio Albion.
Everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is November 25th, 2020. I just finished a book, be the third I'm going to be publishing this year, on the Middle Ages. It is entitled In Regione Quorum Rectus Lucius, Essays on Medieval Political Philosophy. And the Latin phrase means, in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And I think that's extremely apropos of the modern age. It's a defense of medieval political and social ideas in various manifestations. The postmodern hemisphere of death is what I refer to this to this age, and these essays have been published. Now, of course, they're rewritten for this book, substantially rewritten and updated for this book, but they've been published over the last 20 years, all over the place. And what holds them together, of course, is an understanding of the Middle Ages that few people have. By getting into the mind of the time, rather than modernity, reading itself back into earlier ages. It's based on the idea. Really what it comes down to is that modern man lives in conceptual isolation. The Cartesian revolution of the Renaissance altered everything. You know, most people think that ego thinking or individualism is kind of the normal or even natural way to think. But it is very difficult to comprehend a form of cognition that inherently rejects the ego of the thinker. Or at the very least, contextualize it into something much, much larger and greater. But the classical mind thought through the group, not the ego. The latter conception would have been absolutely inconceivable before modernity. So in his isolation, modern man, who is born and raised in the Enlightenment or the post-Enlightenment era, like we all are, we're taught to exist entirely for ourselves. The problem there is that we have a very, very weak store of knowledge for any decision. And so what happens is a absolutely shocking level of irrational choices and deliberate ignorance, personal self-destruction, and the emotional rationalization, ultimately taking the place of human reason. And the system is simply too irrational to continue. The sheer level of mental illness, ignorance, drug addiction, celebrity worship, not to mention debt, and literal insanity can't sustain any kind of life. Analyzing the works of medieval thinkers and ideas, it's a powerful way to show that this postmodern hemisphere of death is irrational. Other civilizational resources exist. Progress is a myth. Science as an ideology is a myth. Technical progress not only has no connection to happiness, but it's made people all the more isolated, alienated, and hateful. The Middle Ages should be studied because people were happier, freer, and more rational than what came later. the modern world is essentially based on the periodization of history. When we go, you know, prehistoric, ancient, medieval, Renaissance, modern, and postmodern. Now, almost all historians see this as progress, with the exception of the medieval part. Progress, of course, is defined by the growth of either technology or finance, or both. So with everything that, that establishment historians say, it's more of a rationalization than a description. The concept of advanced versus primitive has no real meaning except in that context. Ultimately, really, in daily use, it refers to the ability to use a cellular phone to work in a cubicle. It refers to the development of consumer capitalism. In other words, the choices that we're given in the marketplace is evidence that we're free. Freedom is just a silly buzzword that's abstract and purposeless. It's freedom to do nothing in particular. So in a drive to believe that we live in the best possible world, establishment historians are forced to denigrate what's come before. You know, for example, the human lifespan has always been roughly 70 years. This is the case in all eras of history. In the biblical Psalms, it reads, "The lifetime of a man is 70 years, and what is more than this is trial and travail." Well, a score is 20 years. This means, you know, 3,000, 2,500 years ago, the average person lived to be between 70 and 75. You know, today it's very fashionable to be into herbal medicine and natural healing. The suburbanite soccer mom thinks this comes from the Orient. And she thinks to herself how impoverished we are. We should look to the Asians to understand this stuff, and yet herbal healing is a universal, ancient, traditional form of knowledge that all civilizations came to master in their own way. Medicine is no more advanced today than it was then, but the priorities were different. The Middle Ages were completely conversant in this topic with far greater skill than any of these OMDs today. Ignorance of their own culture means they have to go to others, whether it be what they think medieval Asian was, to discover truth. But of course, their own culture is deliberately kept from them, and it's called darkness. And so much of what passes for herbal medicine, etc., is modern speculation, not medieval natural philosophy. I'm certainly not condemning that seeking answers outside of the modern scientific mentality. That's my whole life, to a great extent. Although I'm not a particular expert in medicine, but there is a philosophical approach here that often is done completely out of context. Part of the purpose of this book is to put that in context. All of the great civilizations had a traditional form of medicine and maintain the exact same lifespan. I'm not entirely sure how our ancestors can come through the Black Death in a, you know, mindlessly primitive society. You know, today the cost of healthcare takes up roughly a full seventh of the entire American economy. Hundreds of diseases ravage the population that really never existed before. This includes things like Alzheimer's, certain forms of arthritis, certain kinds of cancer, asthma, chronic liver disease, obstructive pulmonary disease, certainly type 2 diabetes, certain types of heart disease, metabolic syndrome, stroke, certain kinds of stroke, depression, and certainly most obesity, vascular dementia. It's unlikely that any of these really existed in the Middle Ages for a whole bunch of reasons, because the diet was far superior. The regime of physical exercise was everywhere. You have, for example, parts of Greece up until the modern era, you had zero incidence of heart disease. When all they eat is fish and live outside of a toxic environment, you had a lot of coastal societies are like this until the modern era. And even really not too long ago, but the minute, McDonald's and Burger King go in, you see for the first time heart disease, you have vascular issues, you have obesity, you have and everything that goes with this ingestion of chemical. Point is, you don't have to go to, what you think medieval China was to get the answer to that. That's the issue. One thing I deal with in this book is the concept of scholasticism. Many of you remember that I was a Roman Catholic and then a Union through at least the early part of grad school. And I was deeply into this scholastic mentality, especially that of Thomas Aquinas. However, when many of the Orthodox people use the word scholasticism, it's usually used in some kind of a caricature. It's really a pejorative, and it's incorrect to do that. Now, the content of late medieval theology in the West can be problematic. No one denies that. It's not because of the scholastic method. It's not a doctrine. That method is used by Eastern writers all the time. John of Damascus is the most obvious. But what it is it's a form of conceptual analysis that takes a term and seeks to tease out various shades of its meaning. It's really an analytic method using Aristotle as its foundation. It can be used with many fields and disciplines. It does not say that the Christian faith is a rationalist enterprise, but that's how normally it's used. It does say that all aspects of the faith are reasonable, or at the very least, amenable to reason. There is nothing in the faith that requires the credulous leap. God is a creator of reason, and reason, that is logos, pervades the universe. So like recognizes like. Philosophy is the means whereby reason, or logos, is extracted from the realm of appearance, and the unchanging truth, which is what logos is, exposed underneath. There's simply nothing wrong with this. The content of certain, specific doctrinal errors are one thing, but that is not that is not scholasticism. We're talking largely about a method. Both Plato and Aristotle really had the same mission: to tear away the veil of appearance and reveal the essence. That's what all of our work does. In fact, this is the goal of all thought. Theology contains both history and philosophy, and it requires both. History, because it takes place in a historical context, which has to be understood, and philosophy, because it deals with a specific set of metaphysical and ontological concepts, obviously very deeply philosophical. Things like logos, the deification, knowledge, truth, rejection of the flesh, the end of history. These are all conceptions that are philosophical in nature and are older than Orthodox in Christian faith, at least in their foundations. It's common to hear in academic treatments of the late Middle Ages there is a monastic versus a humanist side to Western thinking. There's an Athens and Jerusalem that are opposed to one another. These are also based on a caricature. There was no split between monastic and humanist thinking. There was no Athens versus Jerusalem whatsoever. These are facile distinctions coming from secular historians in the 20th century. No Orthodox body ever rejects reason or the classics of dialectical thinking. The fathers all accepted that revelation is just a higher aspect of reason that might not be attainable without God, can be understood in rational terms. And the incarnation is proof of this. God became man to show he shares in all we do and suffer as we suffer. Authority is always the weakest of all arguments. No one ever argued that a bishop is infallible and orthodox because they're a bishop. No one ever said because a bishop says X, therefore X is true. All authority is conditional on it being reasonable. There's nothing irrational or subrational that's in accordance with the faith. There are modern academic distinctions, which often are used to make an alien time seem easier to understand. It's simply to impose modern distinctions on the medieval world. So the essays in this book stress the idea that the Middle Ages, cognitively speaking, is superior to the age that we live in. Now the problem, of course, is that everyone listening to me was born in a postmodern age. We were born with computers, air conditioning, thank God, caller ID, thank God there, and microwaves. You know, and all these kind of things. But it's very unfair to ask if we'd rather live in the Middle Ages. I don't want to live in any era that doesn't have air conditioning. That's only because we're born and raised in a certain context with very specific expectations. So a question like that is both unfair and stupid. When you're raised with these expectations, our very hard wiring goes into expecting them. Now, if we were born and raised 1,000 years ago, that would be a completely different story. So evolutionary doctrine is the official religion of this age, in part to justify the idea that all previous ages were inferior to the present one. And again, inferior, at least in the scientific and technical side. And liberalism is tightly connected with the idea of progress. But there's one thing that I think most Orthodox people and Roman Catholic people accept, and that is man is a continually devolving animal. Unlike the ideology of progress, man is going in the opposite direction and has been for a long time. Man is today retreating into a animalistic, abysmal status unthinkable even 100 years ago. Americans believe that because they have smartphones and the Romans didn't, Romans are less advanced. Of course, the concept of advanced is defined as having a smartphone. And so this set of essays is an attempt to make this kind of unreason much clearer. Now that's essentially the introduction, this set of essays. This set of essays is mostly philosophical, but of course, philosophy doesn't mean anything unless it's contextualized in a historical and cultural era. Philosophy is obviously based on what's happening around them at the time. But one chapter that I actually wrote many years ago, and like so many of these things, I forget, and I uncover it accidentally, rework it, rewrite it, and it turns out to be something vaguely worthwhile. And it's an essay I did on the Fourth Crusade many years ago. The Fourth Crusade, as we know, is one of the defining events in European history. It's the event that permanently split in a graphic way Europe between Eastern and Western halves. Don't get the impression that East and West were, you know, sealed off entities. That border was very porous. In fact, that border didn't exist at all. Also, be careful not to put too much stock in the year 1054. The Patriarch of Constantinople is not a pope. He's not a dictator. The fact that he had a problem with Pope Nicholas and his successors at the time doesn't mean orthodoxy as such fell away from unity with the West. In fact, at the time, most Eastern bishops were in full communion with the Pope of Rome. This is something that went back and forth for a very long time. Don't impose our modern, you know, Greek versus Latin idea too strictly to this era. That event of 1054 is one out of many splits between the two sides. But the period of time between 1054 and 1204, you have a very fluctuating era between the two sides of Europe, and you had plenty of communion between the two sides. You had many, many Greek churches under the Pope of Rome, and you had many Latin churches under the Greek and later Slavic bishops. That was the norm. That was ordinary. And it's odd how you see so few discussions in this era on liturgy separated between East and West. You see very little of that. And the reason is that the two liturgies were very similar. Doing the Western Rite properly, as was the case when I first heard it done properly, at the Holy Name Abbey in New Jersey, I was shocked to see just how Byzantine it was, just to see how Orthodox it was. Well, people who don't know anything, they think of the Western Rite, and they think of, you know, an Anglican service today. Well, the Anglican service today has zero relation, or almost zero relation, to the Western liturgy 1,000 years ago. You don't have a lot of writing at the time comparing the two liturgies, because there really wasn't a whole lot to compare. The Fourth Crusade, I think, changed all of it. Ultimately, the event is as it's been treated in the literature, centers around the diversion of the crusading army to Constantinople. There in 1204, the imperial city was sacked. After that, it was occupied by Latin, mostly Norman, aristocratic leaders, and the Greeks re-establish smaller states to consolidate their resistance outside of the city. Those states, Epirus in Nicaea, I have dealt with elsewhere. And these are very much worth our time, because these are ethnic nationalist states completely based on the Greek Orthodox culture, and eventually succeeded with the help of the Bulgarians in retaking the imperial city a few generations after. Now, it's not just a catastrophe for Constantinople, but also for the Crusaders. Remember, the initial purpose of the Crusades was to assist the Greeks in fighting off the Islamic threat. Islam is far more of a political doctrine than a religion. It is extremely aggressive and expansionist. People forget that Europe's borders were much larger prior to the rise of Islam. Greco-Latin culture was everywhere in North Africa, in the Middle East. All of the cities were largely Greek. I have several lectures and writings on the fact that Christ himself was born and raised in a Greek environment, in Sepphoris, where Mary is from. You think of the Middle East, which is, of course, is a British distinction much, much later on, as, you know, third world, Arabic, whatever. And at the time, it simply isn't true. And that problem continues to exist. So the two sides of Christendom, at the beginning of the Crusades, of course, not separated, ended up fighting each other anyway, rather than their common enemy, Islam, backed by Judaism. So after sacking the imperial city, the magnitude of that attack made it impossible for those two halves of European civilization to really speak of any kind of reunion. And that was the event that permanently separated both sides. So it took the desperation of the Greek side in the early 15th century to go to the old Rome and promise all kinds of concessions in exchange for money and ships. But the Greek Empire did not recover from the sacking, and it went into a steady decline for two centuries, as we all know, falling to the Turks in 1453. There's an eyewitness to the event, Villehardouin, who wrote The Conquest of Constantinople. He, of course, is a Westerner, and he witnessed many of these events firsthand. His general argument is that the crusade was righteous, but became bogged down in political negotiations that really destroyed the undertaking. Since Villehardouin was the chief negotiator for the Crusaders at the time, his account, of course, can't be entirely objective. He's a defender of the Crusades. He holds that the sacking of the city was intensely sinful, and it comes from the fact that the Crusaders were motivated by greed and really a lack of care for Christendom as a whole. Constantinople was considered holy, and the center of civilization, at least from the First Crusade. The point was to assist them, not to take over. Villehardouin was a defender of Venice, sponsor of the Fourth Crusade. But he does put the blame entirely on the crusading army because they were incapable of fulfilling their promises to the Venetian oligarchy. So Villehardouin is a firm member of the Latin party against both Islam and the Greeks. And so he was part of a more alienated Western society, cut off from the Greeks in Constantinople by language and culture. And many of them, in fact, all of them, were almost completely ignorant of Byzantine politics by the time of the Fourth Crusade. The worst part is that, of course, they proved their ignorance about the war against Islam by completely not understanding it and destroying the operations that the Byzantine Empire had engaged. For the very fact that Villehardouin refers to them as Greeks was at the time considered an insult. Not that there's anything wrong with Greece, because Greece called themselves Romans. The empire, of course, had been based on Constantinople since the early 4th century. Calling them Greek throughout the work, the implication is that they weren't real Romans, because he assumes that Roman has to be Latin. But the title had been given to Charlemagne centuries before as King of the Romans. So this is now another major issue for the two halves of Christendom to fight over. In my book, I have a lengthy chapter on the theological implications of the crowning of Charlemagne. But like most of the Crusades, the impetus to travel, facing great danger, the desire for adventure, of valor, of military exploits, this is what motivated much of the aristocracy, not necessarily abstract theology. Although, don't deny them, at the time, today it might not be the main motivator of anybody, but back then it certainly was. But the other motivator, of course, by the time of the Fourth Crusade, is to spread the papal version of things to Greece. Importantly, you do have the total remission of the results of sin that the Crusaders were usually offered, which is, you know, with the plenary indulgence. Plenary indulgence does not forgive the sins in and of itself, but it certainly forgives their effects, which is often an error. People with, you know, Protestants often make that with indulgences. That's not what an indulgence ever was at the time. They still had to go to confession, even if they won a crusade. And finally, chipping away at the Islamic conquest in the Middle East and North Africa was a huge motive for the Crusades. Now, that's the case from the first to the very end. So Villehardouin is arguing that, you know, while, you know, he does approve in taking the city, he does not approve of its total destruction. and the sacred vessels, ancient relics, gold and silver, so much was stolen and brought back to the West. But like most Westerners, he trusted Greeks even less than the Italians in the East. To him, Greeks were foreigners. They maintained strange customs, challenging Roman claims of jurisdiction. So Villehardouin, by the time of the Fourth Crusade, does say that the course of action here was to take Byzantium, both to bring the Greeks back to Roman obedience, so to speak, and pay back the Venetian oligarchy. Now, one approach here is to make Venice the primary actor, but not to absolve the Crusaders. The Venetian oligarchy was valuable to the Crusaders, but was considered by them as arrogant. The Venetian oligarchy was as much at war with the papacy than it was financing it, although the papacy was largely a Florentine client. So the argument of Villehardouin, again, an eyewitness, is that the Venetians were victims of the ignorant Crusaders. That's his approach in this book. Since the contract between the two was negotiated and sworn, ultimately the Crusaders were at fault for not keeping up their side of the bargain. That's ultimately what Villehardouin will argue here. So there's two implications. First, that the city-state of Venice could take advantage of the huge number of mid-level nobles making their way to the East. Since there's nothing inherently wrong with that in his mind, the Crusaders were usually ignorant of geography in the Far East. I'm sorry, Far East to them, the Greek world, and Middle East. They required the services of the most significant merchant fleet on the planet, which of course is Venice. The major aristocratic signs made a deal with Venice for transport and supplies. The problem was that the nobility were not nearly as well off as the Italians thought. And the army that slowly trickled into Italy was not particularly imposing. They had no extra money to spend. So the contract, which had already been negotiated, shows that Venice had been taken in by a very poor analysis of the Western nobility. Second approach is connected with what I just said. The divisions in Byzantium itself were a way for Venice to get their money back. Unlike the Western nobles, the Greco-Roman Empire was wealthy and long used to dealing with both Genoa and Venice. Don't forget, when you're talking about the Fourth Crusade, Byzantium was in the middle of a civil war. The Emperor Isaac II, had been deposed. His son, Alexios III, sought the Crusaders as leverage against the factions slowly consolidating power in the empire. And his uncle, Alexios IV, also established himself in the imperial city. Now, that kind of conflict is condemned both in the writing at the time and Western writing as well, as Villehardouin proves. Venice, regardless of which position you take on this event, sought one thing: the full dominance and control over the Byzantine Empire. This would give them a well-protected port, a wealthy hinterland, and most importantly, would situate a trading empire at the border of Europe, Africa, and Asia. Now, to a great extent, they did have much of this already. But for them to have a direct control over Greek lands would be absolutely ideal. It's a tremendously strategic position, and it had everything to do with what became the sack of 1204. So the chronicle of Villehardouin is problematic. It's inconsistent. In other words, he absolves the Venetians until they begin their attack on the city. Yet even taking the city and confiscating some of its treasures is legitimate in his mind so long as it was used to pay back the Venetians. So it's indicative that the Western European writing at the time, that he clearly dislikes the Greeks and holds it God's will that what he calls the strongest city in the world fell. So he goes back and forth on this. the diversion of the Crusades is justified again, based on the interests of Venice. So you have two villains in his mind, the Greeks and those Crusaders that did not pay Venice what they were owed. In other words, Venice financed his Crusade, but they wanted their money back with interest. The Crusaders couldn't do it. So while he stresses the religious part of the Crusade, he spends most of his time defending Italian interests. So in this chapter, I go through some of the literature in the field. Hodgman, which is who wrote in 1948, argued that the sack in 1204 was really nothing more than the desire for the Italians to collect on the Crusaders' debt, and maybe secondarily, to extract revenge on the Greeks for the Greek warfare against them in the imperial city. As the Italians extracted greater trading concessions out of the Byzantine Empire this era, anger with their privileges in the Italian privileges in the Holy City was began to grow. There were some pogroms against the Italians in the city itself, but this is the foundation of it. Now, both Alexius III and the IV at the time were fighting it out to take the Emperor Isaac's place, and these divisions were perfect for these Venetian designs. Remember, these city-states were strictly oligarchies. As I've said 100 times, these oligarchical republics had to use much older forms of rule for the bankers to hide behind. But Alexios III in Byzantium was worldly, very intelligent, and really closer to the Venetian mind than his nephew. So the Italians began to trust him, at least relative to the others. And he was given Venetian backing to extract their money by any means necessary. Again, they wanted their investment returned. So, in general, the Western aristocracy had viewed Alexios III as a legitimate heir, forcing his nephew to bribe this band of enthusiastic but incompetent soldiers in the West. In other words, the entire operation was based on deceit, debt, and a promise that no one wanted to keep. The deal that Alexios III made with the Crusaders was based on several promises, and extreme ones. First, that in capturing the city, the Crusaders would then be able to take all they pleased, and from that, pay the Italians back. Second, the vast resources of the empire would feed and direct the Crusaders to their desired target. And third, to create a Greek army of about 10,000 to support the Crusaders. And finally, Byzantium would bow to papal authority. So the writings of Hodgman argue that was the promises of Alexios III to the Crusaders that created the conditions for the destruction of the city. Importantly, and he adds an addendum here, he argues that the ignorant and poor Westerners, when seeing the imperial city for the first time, were both envious and then awestruck by its immense wealth. They had never seen anything like this before. The Crusaders realized that Alexios had access to far more wealth than either the Crusaders or the Italians understood, or at least the Crusaders understood, and certainly more than they needed. Rebuilding the West on the ruins of the Greeks became a priority. Alexios IV was anti-Latin, as were most Greeks at the time. So when Alexios III arrived with a bodyguard of Roman Catholic Crusaders, there was no question as to his lack of legitimacy, especially in the eyes of the common population. The Crusaders may have been ignorant of the fact that it was his association with them that created this lack of legitimacy in the first place. 1976, John Godfrey made two arguments in his work on the subject. First, that the diversion of the Crusade to Byzantium was not a diversion at all, but was in fact the original policy of Venice as soon as the Crusaders arrived. Pope Innocent III did have primarily religious motives in the Crusades, but did not object to taking the city and bringing it under papal control. And secondly, part of the problem was Venice wanted its coastal colonies returned, including the port city, the very wealthy city of Zara. So initially, the Crusaders, seeking Italian assistance, had to do some legwork for them first. He also argues that the role of Pope Innocent III could never be minimized. He was one of history's most powerful popes. He was made of an absolutely iron will, very sharp intellect, and relative to papal politics, a very strong moral focus. He was one of the most extreme proponents of papal power over the entire world. Now, I'm not saying that he ordered, Godfrey is not saying that he ordered the sacking. No one says that. He didn't. In fact, was quite taken aback by events as they unfolded. He did excommunicate the entire army when he learned that the Italians were using them to gain profitable coastal cities, which were at the time, by the way, held by the Hungarians. Now, his motivation for excommunication was not about the violence used to capture Zara, but that the Magyar overlords were Roman Catholic. Fighting other Catholics was absolutely out of the question. At the time, though, the Greeks were not in communion with the papacy, and therefore attacking them is perfectly acceptable. But Innocent was not expecting the savage bloodshed that eventually resulted. The port city of Zara, it seems, was just a prelude. Forgetting all about the menace of Islam, the imperial city needed to be next. Since Greeks were not papal in their theology, what could be more praiseworthy than that? Taking the city of Zara and all of its wealth only showed the Crusaders that the East had much that they didn't. And the central focus of this wealth was Constantinople. Now, after the sacking of the city, Pope Innocent retracted his earlier condemnation of the violence. And Villehardouin also notes this. And he does this by installing papal legates, bishops, and nobles on formerly Greek lands that had been stolen. The Venetians were able to install their own patriarch over the church, whose name was John. Godfrey then concludes the real reason for Innocent's shock at the sacking of the city really had nothing to do with the violence itself, but that it diverted the army from its main purpose, to do battle with expansionist and very competently led Islamic world. After 1204, crusading was no longer really a movement of popular significance. Battles with Islam were, from then on, accomplished by the Brotherhoods and regular forces specializing in Islamic warfare through crusaders. It failed, and in the Fourth Crusade, destroyed the crusading idea in general. So the two writers, Godfrey and Hodgman, agree. The one thing that they hold is that all the sides are at fault. Overall, though, the Greeks are not condemned, except that in the Civil War, turned out to be an excuse for Venice to extract revenge and money and ultimately the destruction of the city. And they were rivals, of course. But for these authors and like anyone looking at the Fourth Crusade, no one comes out looking less moral than the Venetians. Carl Erdmann wrote in 1977, made the argument, this is, became a common argument as the 20th century wore on, that the Crusades in general, and the Fourth in particular, were part of the overall centralization and militarization of the papacy, really from the time of Gregory VII onward. Now, his main argument for this is that the crusading army was purely secular. The Fourth Crusade was a completely secular affair. It had no real religious significance in the West. Now, such a view would have to concede that the diversion of the army was no diversion at all. It was adventure and valor and glory that the Crusaders wanted had nothing to do with Islam. It would make no difference if it came from Egypt or the Aegean coast. It didn't make any difference. However, Erdman and those like him, they do make one assertion that seems questionable. He asserts that the liberation of Eastern Christianity was the fundamental aim of the war. But in other words, they had a altruistic motive. Now, this is iffy largely because the Greeks were never trusted by the Latin Sea in Rome. And the Greeks had major sees in Antioch and Jerusalem. They had been out of communion with each other for, you know, on again, off again for a century and a half. So he's wrong to say that there was a desire to rescue them. But given the theology of the day, they did want to replace them. Now, he'd be correct if by liberation he meant conversion. We should note that the papacy declared crusades against Russia on a regular basis after that, using the Teutonic Knights, Poles, Lithuanians, whoever they had at their disposal. So in Villehardon's contemporary account, he states that the clergy among the crusaders spread the message that the Greeks were traitors, and this comes from Queller's article, that Greeks were traitors and murderers and disloyal since they had murdered their rightful lord, and they were therefore worse than the Jews. That was the clerical message among the Fourth Crusade. Because of this, again, the Greeks were seen as a legitimate target of the Crusade, not even Islam. So Erdman's argument should be taken very seriously. And in fact, his work became the standard for some time. He has a cynical approach where he says that the religious side of things was largely a ruse. Money, political expansion, that was the basis of the Fourth Crusade. Doesn't explain, though, how the Crusaders mortgaged everything they had and everything they owned to go and face almost certain death in the East. Crusaders were far from enriched by their endeavors. Many never saw their homes again. Now, of course, you know, secular academics are going to look at everything as secular men. Academics themselves, backbiting and seeking only their own self-interest, so it stands to reason they're going to impose this on everything they study. And that's why that particular assertion of his was questionable. Leclerc et al. Argues in 1968, a bit before that, that didn't separate the Fourth Crusade from the spiritual revival that took place in the centralized and reformed papacy. In other words, Leclerc argues that the Crusades derive from two sources. The upsurge in spiritual life typified the 11th century Renaissance in the West, and second, as a result, the increased interest in pilgrimages to the East. The pilgrims brought back stories of both the perfidy of the Greeks and the savagery of Islam. And this is some of the ideological motivation for the Crusade. And it was Giles Constable who first argued that religious reform and personal experience, these are the main motives of all crusades, including the Fourth. Constable's entire work on the subject revolves around the increasing reform of the papacy, which included things like, you know, claims to infallibility, centralization, jurisdiction over the Greeks, clerical celibacy, which was a revolutionary idea, and the reorganization of the monastery, among other things. The point is that the Fourth Crusade had to do really with two things. In his mind, to force the Greeks to accept papal power and protect the Church of Rome from the violence of the Muslims. But you read the work on the Fourth Crusade, sometimes the word Islam barely appears, and that you should take seriously. So those approaches, the last two I mentioned, are unique because they base their foundation on the desire to alter the very nature of monasticism. Normally, asceticism involved manual labor, social service to a great extent, selling all your non-essential goods, fasting, of course, everything that you think that a monk does. The monk's day was a difficult one, but a rewarding one. So, fighting for the faith, suffering long journeys, facing almost certain death or severe injury, being home for years, being away from home for years, mortgaging all one's property to finance it all, was even a more severe form of asceticism than a traditional monk. Therefore, the mind of Pope Innocent III, the Crusader, was a monk to the highest degree, since his ascetic struggle was far more intense and potentially more life-threatening than the average Benedictine. And it certainly is something worth discussing. Now, two other writers on this subject, Queller, 1976, and Day in 1974, have two major works on this question, especially in the Fourth Crusade. Separate from the question of monasticism, they do argue that Venice was more or less a sacrificial victim of the Crusaders' ignorance. The basic argument is that Venetians tirelessly worked for the Crusade, almost going broke, creating the navy needed to transport this number of knights. Both these writers depict the Venetians as heroic and selfless, and thanked with the complete inability to pay, and even worse, the inability to leave. So the diversion of the Crusade, according to these guys, was legitimate, given the amount of labor and money spent. It isn't so much the diversion of the Crusade and taking a town like Zara or even Constantinople, it's that they needed their money back, and that is considered by these guys a legitimate reason for the diversion. Now, not for the slaughter by any means, but... So Queller, for example, whose book came out in 1974, argues that one of the major problems with the Fourth Crusade was the lack of leadership and the lack of loyalty among the knights coming from the West. And this is a common argument. The self-interest, even if the self-interest was purely spiritual or material, was the only thing keeping the army together. Not to mention the army's size. The envoys, making their deal with Venice, promised over 30,000 men. Experienced knights, but a fraction of this actually showed up. So the merchant middlemen from France struggled to extract any cash from this army. And they were ultimately capable of paying maybe just under half of what was owed. Many of the Crusaders didn't converge on Venice as originally planned, but they sailed from Marseille instead, in France. These refused to attack Zara due to Innocent's threat of excommunication, which we've already mentioned. Now, showing sympathy to Venice, and this is, you know, this is a minority point of view, that Venice actually is defended, but you have a few, and these guys are the two. They both argue, in both pieces, both writers, they argue that the massive investment that Venice put into this crusade obligated to make the building of such a massive navy, capable of transferring over 30,000 men, not to mention the supplies and horses and everything else, bringing Venice to bankruptcy. That's the point here. So when the Venetian oligarchy couldn't collect, opposition factions in the city might blame the oligarchy itself, or the executive doge, who was the chief executive of the city. They might blame him for the debacle. Then, the diversion to the port city of Zara was not popular among the Crusaders. It was seen by them as a diversion of a diversion, and one really only benefited Venice. So the Crusaders come to Central Europe and they come to Eastern Europe, distrusting both the Venetians and the Greeks. Not to mention the Catholic, Zara, as I mentioned before, is a Catholic city, and that was a very unattractive target. Simon de Montfort defected entirely, and with about 1,000 men, sailed directly to the Holy Land. But of course, with so few, he really didn't do anything. So Venice did get shafted here. By the time at least some of the army reached Accra, you know, in the Middle East, one of the papal states or the crusading states. Believe it or not, they found a state of peace between the crusaders and the Islamic armies. Now, Emperor Alexius required the crusaders to keep him safe on the throne, and he was considered, as I mentioned before, an agent of the Pope. Therefore, the crusaders were faced with three problems by 1203. They saw the crusading states, so-called Ottoman states, unwilling to break this truce with Islam, meaning that their entire mission in the Middle East was useless. Second one was Alexios was illegitimate in the eyes of the Greeks. So supporting him was useless. And then finally, the invasion of the Roman Catholic city, at the time under control of the Hungarians, for the benefit of only the oligarchs in Venice. Attacking other Catholics was a huge problem. So you can conclude that the events of 1204 was ultimately pure frustration, and the desire eventually to achieve anything of value, knowing full well that Venice is now in a lot of trouble. Now, Alexios IV was murdered by the crusaders for being anti-papal. One day later, all this is happening, this is April 9th, 1204, the army invaded the city, but were driven back. The return of Baldwin, Flanders, who actually was a claimant to Constantinople, his return emboldened the army, and they suffered. I mean, they had been defeated, they had a guilty conscience, they were threatened by excommunication for the Zara issue, and of course, now you have the plague. But this was sufficient to breach the walls, and Baldwin was then installed as emperor amid the rioting and looting that everyone knows happened in 1204 in Constantinople. So it shouldn't surprise anybody that those who initially opposed this crusade suddenly realized that they supported it all along and wanted the land grants that came with all this, and they rushed to the defeated city to claim their share of the loot. So Queller and Day in 1976 argue that the Venetians were the dominant force in directing the crusading army wherever it really wanted. This is really the whole question here. So you do have those defending Venice. There's four issues here concerning the Venetian case in the Fourth Crusade. First, a crusading enthusiasm, a religious enthusiasm, was foreign to the Venetian psyche. Number two, that Venice compelled the crusading army to comply with its plans, which were treacherous. Three, remember, their initial target was really Egypt, upon which the Venetians and the crusaders had agreed in 1201, turned out to be disadvantageous to Venice's interest. And finally, Venice was suffering setbacks in Constantinople that focused their attention exclusively on securing their position in Greek areas, having nothing to do with Egypt anymore. Now, these writers, the last two I mentioned, if those four statements can be shown to be false, then that would revolutionize the field. So there's not a lot of these guys make the argument that there's far more religious impulse in the Venetian endeavor than mercantile interests. So they try to argue that stigmatizing the Venetians with the mercantile label is legitimate, but you have to treat the other actors as being equally so motivated. So from the First Crusade onward, the Venetian Navy was involved in combat on a regular basis. So they argue that that Venice was in essence a secular state seeking only commercial benefits is just not true. Well, of course it is true, just not entirely true. Given Venice's profitable enterprises in Byzantine territory, they argue, there's no reason whatsoever to desire the instability of a wealthy and generally stable Greek market. This often gets forgotten about people you're condemning the Venetians. Not to mention the fact that the very existence of the Crusader states did not serve Venice either. They had the ability to capture goods for trade before they reached Byzantium, given their location. In fact, the income from these outrimmer states was, at least in part, derived from this newfound role as a middleman. So really, there was little advantage to the Venetians, whose labor for the Crusaders would have cost them far more than they ever received in payment, even if the contract had been upheld. So it resulted in taxes in Venice going up. They had to raise their labor from elsewhere to make this massive navy possible. So there was no subterfuge on the part of the Venetians in this case. The problem was that the envoys of the crusading forces had no idea, and hence couldn't estimate the number of men that would be arriving, or their financial resources. These authors will argue that the Venetian price for assistance, compared to the much smaller but similar contract they had with Genoa a decade before, so a price per crusader only slightly higher. This immense investment is something that some people wanted to say the Venetian investment couldn't have been entirely commercial, outfitting hundreds of ships. And of course, this might have been profitably deployed elsewhere. Anyway, that's just a brief summary of one of my chapters on the Fourth Crusade. And people simply don't realize the significance of this era in European history, certainly don't realize the significance of the Fourth Crusade above and beyond the destruction of Constantinople. So much of the medieval mind can be found in the contradictions and problems of the Crusades, whether it be the outrimmer states or Venice or Genoa or the Greeks. Many times I've argued that the Crusaders, kind of like bulls in china shops, smashing in to the east, completely upset the Greek intelligence operations. The Greeks had used one faction of Muslims against another. They come smashing in here, having no idea what's going on, and they upset this whole thing. I've argued many times that regardless of the motivation of the Crusaders, and many of the motivations were very, very good ones, they simply didn't know enough about Middle Eastern politics to make much of a difference. Anyway, as I said before, this book will be coming out very soon. It's at the publishers. In Regione Gaecorum Rex et Lucius, Essays on Medieval Political Philosophy, published by Fermata Books this year. And it's my set of essays on the Middle Ages. Everything from Justinian to Augustine to Romanesque architecture, to Thomas Aquinas, to the zealots in the Byzantine Empire. I try to deal with as many of these as possible. As always, I require your assistance to live. These books don't net me much money. There's really not a market for hard copy books anymore. I do it, and I used to give them away for free. Now I can't. So any of you who can assist me financially, as always, I beg of your help, as I always do. And our situation is getting more and more desperate, but this work simply has to be done. Thank you, everyone, again for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.